To better your best and your world, you need to dig deep and grow. Join us as top experts, leaders, and creators uncover powerful insights to help you grow in life and in work. And now, your host, Michael McAvoy. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Dig Deep Grow, the show dedicated to helping you better your best and your world. I'm Michael McAvoy, your host, and we are live. Today, we're going to be talking about decision-making and how important that is in our lives, because a lot of times we make decisions without even understanding what goes on in our minds, in our hearts, in order to come to those decisions. So we'll be talking with author Jeff Schinnebarger and about his new book. It's called Yes or No, How Your Everyday Decisions Will Forever Shape Your Life. I just completed reading it, and it is a good book. We're gonna get into some of the helpful tips that Jeff has. So, Jeff, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, it's great to be on the call with you.
Perfect. So, the first thing I'll ask is, are you talk a little about your background and how you came to being somewhat of an expert on the subject of making decisions?
Well, I'll tell you, being an expert at decision making is. I don't know that I could claim that. I can claim that I've had a hard time making decisions for years. Maybe that's what made me an expert. When I was 24, I got the opportunity to lead an event called Catalyst, and I remember that first year I was leading it, I was put into multiple situations where, truthfully, I didn't know what to do. What do you do when you don't know what to do, right? And I think over the last 10 years, I'm 34 now. I've just found time and time again. My wife and I are in these situations. Everyone's sitting at a table, and they're all looking at me to make a choice, you know. And it's hard. It seems like every week there's a new decision that I have to make that I probably wasn't fully prepared for the week before, and it's a new category. I think I used to think that making decisions would be easier over time. But it becomes more and more challenging as the questions become more and more complicated. So I would say, to answer your question, how did I become an expert? Well, I was in a bunch of moments where, truthfully, I didn't know how to make the decision, and I've had to wrestle with that for the last 10 years.
Yeah, I will make an observation that the answer to your question is kind of aligned with how you've written this book, in that you don't present yourself as, hey, this is the way you do it. It'll work for you. There's a lot of self introspection and, getting to what is good for each individual. So you don't come off as being overly, like the expert type. So maybe I phrased the question wrong. But it's a nice balanced approach is the best way I would say it. So, anyway, the book is called Yes or No, How Your Everyday Decisions Will Forever Shape Your Life. Now people usually will come up to a life-changing decision, and those are the ones in particular that they get stuck on, they get frozen, they procrastinate, all of those things, and you go into a number of things that happen during that process. Can you frame for people a little of what people usually go through and maybe how they might approach it differently?
Yeah, I think, and I mean, people listening to this, I have a feeling there's people that have either, are wrestling through something right now, or they have in recent days, right? I think there's three different types of decisions. The first is the mundane decisions. I've heard the stat that the average person makes 5,000 decisions in a day. Everything from, what are you going to wear that day, to how you're going to put those clothes on, to what way you drive to work, right? Those are all these mundane decisions that we instinctively make. But the ones that are hard are these moments of tension or transition. And the moments of transition, like maybe you're in a moment in life where you're trying to decide between, leaving your day job and pursuing your dream. Or maybe you're in a moment of tension where you have an employee that's come to you and they're complaining about something and they want you to fix it, These are all challenging moments that we all have to process, and the truth is what we say yes and no to will define who we will become and what we are known for. And that's, you know, kind of the root of where we began writing this book.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So people have different styles, and you talk about decision-making styles. I had an interesting irony when I was reading the chapter on different styles. I was thinking, wow, there's so many different styles. How can I make a decision which one is mine? You know, so even in, you know, inside the book, I was finding, you know, that dilemma of finding it. But you do say you can you're welcome to mix and match on those. Anyway, so in the beginning of the book, you talk about, you know, finding purpose. And about the, you know, where do you sit with your heart? So I want you to talk a little about perhaps about you and how you've personally come to making decisions. Sounds to me like you are more of a heart-centered person in your approach, but I'll get your answer on that.
Yeah, so I think everyone, we've kind of decided there's this philosophy of choice that we all have that drive our decisions. And those are rooted really in three different questions. And you were asking earlier, you mentioned earlier that my approach to writing this wasn't like, oh, Jeff's the expert. But hopefully in this book, you know, I've given people questions to ponder how they want to make choices, right? I can never make a decision for someone else. These are your decisions you have to make. So these three questions that people have to really wrestle through, and this is in the first few chapters of the book. The first one is, what or who do you love? And, man, if you start there, you can instantly say things like, oh, I love my family, or I love my spouse. But sometimes, unfortunately, and your spouse may have told this to you at some point, that your decisions are not matching up with what you say you love, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the tension becomes like, well, are you going to stay late at work, or are you coming home? That's a tough tension. You know? What do you love more?
Mm-hmm.
And we always say, and you've probably heard this before, you can determine what someone loves by looking at how they spend their money and how they spend their time. Those are really practical decisions you make on a daily basis that should line up with what you love, what you care about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first part, is what or who do you love? The second is what wisdom have you been given? So over the course of the life that you have, there is wisdom that you can gain from education you've experienced or experiences you've gone through that have brought you wisdom, failures you've had, things like that, or successes you've had. Or potentially a lot of the wisdom that you've gained could be from reading you've done or, you know, a faith system that drives your decisions. You know, for me, that comes from a Christian faith background that mm-hmm. would drive how I make choices.
Mm-hmm.
And that wisdom, I would say, is really built into the overall way that I translate my life experience towards others.
Mm-hmm.
So the first question, what do you love? The second, what wisdom have you been given? And the third is, what do you hope to be known for? And this is the question that I think most people don't take the time to really ponder. To imagine in the future, what do you feel your unique contribution is to the world? What are you uniquely designed to do that drives your calling? What are you going to do? What are you made to do that no one else can do? There's a lot of things we can do. Like my friend Bob Goff says, there are many things we can do, and there are a few things we are made to do.
Mm.
So once you know, that third question of what do you hope to be known for, once you have a perspective on that, it makes decisions easier because you're going towards a direction. So that would be the starting place, I think, to understanding what your philosophy of choice might be.
Okay. So you mentioned during your answer, you know, that you do take your faith in your decision making. And, you know, by the way, there is, you know, there's the mention of faith in your book, but it's not overpowering. It's not like some books are, you know, clearly, you know, religion type books, but this is not the case. But the question that I want to ask on that is that a lot of times people in those tension decisions, I think that's how you termed it. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
These are crisis, sometimes crisis moments, and a lot of times people will turn to their faith in order to get those answers. So, you know, even people who aren't quote-unquote religious in those moments might, sit down and say a prayer, trying to get an answer. So just wondering, from that approach, how do you check or internally, kind of verify for yourself that it's not you talking, that you are getting your answers through your faith?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that's a balance we all have to have. I would say one thing that you can definitely do, and this is, I think we have to get feedback from people that really believe in us and that want us to succeed and that share a similar faith system, right? So I'll give you an example. I think that we all have people in our lives that could, downplay every idea or decision we make. There'll be haters in every scenario, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the no people. And then there's people that we have in our lives that are yes people. These are the ones that you could come up with anything and they say, man, that's a great idea, Jeff. You should go after it, And those are not the people either. But if you surround yourself with people that have shared values as you have and that are looking to be kind of wise voices that believe in you, that want to invest in you, that want you to succeed, that have walked a long life with you, they've seen what your strengths are and your weaknesses are,
mm-hmm.
they're going to speak into your decisions in a really good way. And I think whatever faith system you may have, I think that God speaks through those people into your life also and can affirm what you feel like you're hearing you ought to do. Does that make sense?
Yes, that does. You relate several stories about you and your wife before you're married and after you're married. And I don't recall the exact story, but the gist was that when you presented an idea, you could share it in a moment. Your wife pretty much said, "I don't see it," and you wisely made the choice not to move forward. That you remember the story in the book?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, it's been a lot of stories she said no to me over the years, right? which is a very healthy thing, honestly. This story was I was working with my friend Charles. We were potentially going to write a book together. We are longtime friends, and so we had spent a weekend together and actually outlined this entire book and figured out the plan. I flew to California to be with him and to figure this out. Andre, my wife's name is Andre. She knew what we were doing, and we got back, and I introduced everything to her. I mean, it wasn't just an idea. Like, we had a plan. And I remember introducing it to her, and she said, Jeff, I've been thinking a lot about it while you were gone and praying about it and trying to figure out if this is the right thing for our family. And she said, I don't think we should do this. This isn't right. I'm going to have to say no on this one. And this is after I had spent a whole weekend, outlining an entire book. And I was like, no, it didn't. I was like, why? And she didn't have a reason. She just didn't feel good about it or right about it. Like, it wasn't right for our family at that time. She was not content with it being the right decision. So I had to call my friend Charles and say, well, I can't do this. And the reason being is my wife said no. And if she says no, I can't do it. I'm not going to fight it. She just said no. She's very adamant. Well, we didn't realize. And so, so he was like, I guess we're not going to do it then. And what was crazy is 3 months later, we had put paperwork in for our adoption. And it was just a couple months later, about 3 months after that major decision, that we were matched for our first daughter. Our daughter, her name is Jada. And we were matched, and we picked up Jada 4 days later. So it's amazing how sometimes the people in your life that you trust and believe the most, and they believe in you, have, also this ability to speak into our decisions, and that God speaks to them at certain times. So I didn't know all that in that moment, but it all made sense in hindsight of why I had to say no to that situation. There's no way I could have got that book done and had an infant 3 months later. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. Get this podcast delivered to you automatically. You can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, and more. You'll find the links here or on our website, digdeepgrow.com. So does that mean that you have always you know, when you've had that counsel, say from your wife or whatever, that you've never said, hey, I'm just going to have to go with my decision on this one. I just feel so strongly about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in marriage, you definitely have tensions, right, mm-hmm. where you have to kind of work through those things together. And you have certain feelings or certain styles. And I think, you know, you mentioned earlier about the decision-making styles. I think understanding, and this has been fun to actually already start wrestling with friends about this, where a husband and wife oftentimes or whatever partner you have in life, you may not be married yet, whatever, you know, you have different decision-making styles that you are the driver of how you make decisions. And understanding that about each other, and, you know, sometimes one person trumps over the other person and they have a different feeling of how to move forward or reason of how to move forward. You have to kind of work that thing out. And in the same way, not even just marriage, I mean, like a partner in business or, you know, a coworker, these styles and ways that people make decisions drive how you make decisions. So do you want me to share those?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Yeah, so there's seven different decision-making styles we've realized. And how we've come to this is over the last 3 years, I've been meeting and mentoring all these different startup individuals. Some are doing nonprofit organizations. Some are leading for-profit organizations. And we joke there's also a handful of them that are for-profit organizations that have not made any kind of profit, right? Those are all part of the mix of people we've been mentoring and working with. But what we've learned is that that there's these unique styles that we all have that are the ways that we naturally make decisions. So the seven styles, the first one is the gut reaction. That's what I am. I'm a very feeling-oriented person. So when there's a problem in front of me, I have a gut instinct, an instant reaction of what I think we ought to do. The second style would be the list approach. This is these are the people that make pros and cons lists. So they're always writing these things down. They'll literally draw a piece of paper and, you know, make a line down the middle. And on one side, they'll say, we should do these things. And on the other side, it says, this is why we should not make this decision. It's funny because sometimes people that have these pros and cons lists, if you look back at a job you might have decided to take like 4 or 5 years ago, you probably still have that pros and cons list of why you chose to make that decision. The challenge with those people is that we all know pros and cons never end. You can always come up with another positive or negative, so you have to eventually make a choice. The third would be the data-driven. These are individuals that are looking at the numbers, constantly looking at numbers to make a choice. But the problem is sometimes you can't know all the numbers. So you can't predict the future all the time. The fourth would be the story-living. These are people that live by the mentality of you only live once, right? YOLO. They are always looking to do something that they've never done before. And these people are a ton of fun, especially around a campfire in the fall, right? They have the best stories you can ever imagine. They'll keep you up really late at night. The fifth would be collective reasoning. These are the people who love to get everyone in a room and take a vote for every major decision. They are very inclusive. They're not exclusive. The challenge of those people is that if there's a split vote, they have a hard time making the decision. You know, the sixth would be the spiritually guided. These are individuals that go away for a weekend maybe and really pray about what they ought to do next. And oftentimes they have great moments of clarity in those times. And then the seventh style would be the passive undecided. And I have multiple friends that are this way, that they're truly fine with whatever anyone else decides on their behalf. They would just do everything possible to not have to make a decision. So those are the seven different styles.
Okay, yeah. Would you draw a little distinction between the gut reaction one and the spiritual? Because it seems to me there may be some overlap there.
That's interesting, yeah. There probably are. I mean, both of them have feeling and emotion built into it. Mm-hmm. The thing that I think is often the differentiator is gut reaction people have an instant decision. So they're really great when timelines are very short and they have an instinct as to how to move forward. Oftentimes they've actually trained their bodies in some ways to make instincts. I think about a friend of mine who plays basketball. in real time on the basketball court, they're able to make instinctive reactions based on what's happening in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you get that
yes.
kind of mentality?
Yeah.
The spiritually driven oftentimes take longer amount of time and really make dedicated time for prayer or solitude or to make a choice, I'm feeling, but taking the time of going through that process. Does that help?
Yeah, that does. I'll ask you one question that's highlighted in chapter 6. And by the way, at this point, I should mention that we do have a couple of copies, extra copies of the book. So if you'd like to get a copy of the book, just send an email with your name and address to liveshow@digdeepgrow. That email, liveshow@digdeepgrow. And the first come, first serve, we'll get a copy of it out to you. So Jeff, on chapter 6, the question is asked, how do you naturally make decisions? And this is, again, how do you find your decision-making process? Can you talk a little about that? And then we'll talk about the actual designing or, getting down to the nitty-gritty.
Absolutely. So one thing, anyone that's listening can take, we have a decision-making assessment to understand what your style is. And you can get that at yesornobook.com. It's a totally free assessment. You don't have to buy the book. You don't have to do anything. It's just on there for free. We started this about just 2 weeks ago, and we've already had over 6,000 people take the assessment,
wow.
Which has been kind of neat.
Yeah.
And it's a five-minute little kind of quiz assessment, and it'll determine what your decision-making style is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd highly recommend checking that out and share it through Facebook or Twitter with your friends. And it gives you information about your kind of good things about your and strengths about your style and also challenges that could emerge. So that would be the first thing. And I think as people listen and consider the decision-making styles, oftentimes I think people, they'll listen to it and they'll say, well, I'm kind of a cross between a gut reaction and a data-driven person. And that totally makes sense. I think depending on the situation, you could have a different style that emerges a little bit more than the others. Some people like to not be defined, in that way. And, we could say that you have a chameleon-like reaction to decision-making style. That'd be the positive of it. But I really believe, like, when you think about decisions like maybe buying your house or choosing a spouse or maybe what job to take, major life decisions like that, I've always noticed that most people have one driver that is more important to them than the other six that exist. So, it might not, your decision-making style might not come out when you're choosing what to eat on Friday night or whatever. But I think these major choices, ones really, really stick out.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to share the story about the pile of chips in a moment. But I want to read one quote, which I really liked from the book. It's on page 62. It says, when we enter a time of transition, this is the right time to ruthlessly examine which things we like and which things we love. Could you say a little something about that sentence?
Could you say it one more time? I missed the first part of it.
Okay.
Hard time here.
Yeah, when we enter a time of transition, this is the right time to ruthlessly examine which things we like and which things we love.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it was interesting. My wife and I took a sabbatical about 3 years ago, and we went to Nicaragua for 3 months. And it was an amazing time for us because we actually, to be able to take 3 months away, you have to quit everything you do on a weekly basis. So we were, volunteering at our church. We were leading different groups through our kids' schooling, all these different things. And we basically just said, hey, we actually have to leave the country, and we have to quit this. And it was the first time we were able to actually have an exit strategy to all these projects we were involved in. And it made us really think about, over those 3 months, what we wanted to get back involved in. What did we really miss? What did we love doing? What communities did we really want to invest our time and energy into in the future? Most of us don't have exit strategies for all these functions or volunteer opportunities or things that we start. It's just we say, well, we'll get together once a month. We'll get together every week. We add and add and add. But if you never say, if you don't ever use the word no and end things, then it's hard to become known for anything. You know, you have to carve things off. When we were in Nicaragua, we had this story that I like to share, where we would take these bikes and ride. It was about 5 miles down to the water and 5 miles back. We get down to the water, and there was this kid that had a piece of plywood balanced on top of a 5-gallon bucket. And there was a sign on his piece of plywood that it just said $1 and an arrow pointing up. And I was like, what is this? You know, so the first time I kind of sat there and looked at what he was doing, so people would give him $1, and he'd climb up this tree. It was a coconut tree. He'd get all the way to the top. He'd grab the coconut. He'd shimmy back down. And he would take a machete and start carving the coconut to get to the center. And, you know, he'd basically create a coconut drink. And it was interesting to me because I was thinking about this relating to my purpose, the reason I exist. I think there's moments where we all have to shed things that are on the outside to get to the core of what we're made to do. You know, if you look at a coconut and a green coconut on the outside, it really doesn't look like it has any purpose. But when you start shaving and getting to the middle of it, there's coconut milk in the middle, right? That's the sweetness. It's what the intention of that thing is. And there's points at which, you know, there's a lot of things we can do, but there's very few things we're made to do. Again, Bob Goff says that. And we have to find ways to shed these things that we like doing to get to what we're made to do.
Right. Now I'm going to ask you about the pile of chips in just a moment, but on that answer, it kind of reminds me a little bit about the idea of minimalism, and I just want to ask if you apply that in your life in any particular ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, the previous book I wrote was called More or Less. I don't know if you knew that or not. I told you that.
I was aware, yes.
Yeah, so I really, it's all about challenging what is enough in life. And, you know, the truth is, what is enough for me will never be enough for you. We wrestle through this tension. We easily get caught up in wanting what other people have, but we rarely make the decision for us of what is enough. And so I've wrestled with this for years, my wife and I have, especially when we're in a community where we get to interact with homeless and some different people than we probably ever have before, where you wrestle with how to love your neighbor when your neighbor has no home. Mm-hmm. You start looking at what you have in a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question about minimalism, I mean, the tension for me is always there. Because truthfully, like, my American mentality wants more of everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like right now I'm wrestling through, I want a fire pit in my backyard. Do I need a fire pit in my backyard? No. Can I justify it? Yeah, absolutely. I can have people over. It could be this community-based thing. And we may end up getting a fire pit. The fire pit's not the issue. It's just like, I think having a real consciousness about what you're getting, why you're getting it, what the purpose of it is, and asking those hard questions along the way, I think is really healthy. Because if you can live on less, truthfully, you have the opportunity to give more towards others, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, how I've come to grips with that whole reality. We've actually started multiple projects where we're challenging what is excess, and we've been able to help other people because of we're limiting the excess we have in our lives.
Right. Okay. All right. So let's move now and give people some real concrete ideas about the decision-making process. And to begin, tell the story about the pile of chips, because it's very illustrative of where we're going with this.
Oh, the plywood chips. That is a great or horrible story, depending on how you look at it and whose perspective you're looking at. Did you like that story?
Yeah, it was great. And it's amazing how the angles you've looked at with that. But go ahead, you have to share it.
We'll see if I remember all. But basically, the short story is my wife and her mom and dad were at our house, and I was at work. And I always call my wife right before, you know, I'm on my way home, so, you know, she knows that I'm out the office and almost back. And she said, "Oh, Jeff, yeah. Hey, I got a surprise for you. When you get home, you know, I'll show it to you." And I was like, what surprise? And she just kind of hung up on me. I was like, what happened? What is a surprise? So I get home, pull into our driveway, and instantly I knew what the surprise was. And it was basically this humongous pile of wood chips. My mother-in-law, Sandy, she had told Andre that, you know, there's these tree cutting services that sometimes if they're in the area, they'll give you all the wood chips from a tree they just cut. And so they looked on the internet and found the first one. They called and the tree cutting service said, "Yeah, oh yeah, we're right. We're in the neighborhood. Do you have a space for a truckload?" And Andre says, "Oh, absolutely. We have a huge driveway. Just bring it on over." And she really didn't ask how big of a truck it was. We learned that it was 20 cubic yards of wood chips, which basically, you imagine, it was about 10 feet wide and about, it was a good 20 feet long and 10 feet tall. I mean, it was a humongous pile of wood chips and mountainous. Literally, it was as high as our roof. And so I got home, we had this huge pile of wood chips. And, you know, the story is like, what was I going to do in that moment? We have this huge pile of wood chips, and, you know, what do you do when you don't know what to do? So all these things ran through my head. I thought, you know, we could bag it up and give it to people, other people to use in their yards, or we could spread it. We have a big garden in our backyard. So the goal was to use it for the garden. So we used all of that. We made signs that people could come and pick up free wood chips, like, on our street. I mean, there was 10 different things that we tried, and ultimately it took us about 4 months to get rid of all the wood chips from our driveway. And, it's this moment that you sit there and you're like, what do you do when you don't know what to do? And you think of all these options of things that you could do. Now, those were the kind things. Some of the more challenging things were, you know, I wanted to tell Andre she had to take care of all the wood chips and get them out of the yard, and she wasn't able to come in the house till they were gone. You know, like there was the selfish parts of this also. So, but it was a very funny story. You know, we all get in these moments where we're like, what just happened? You know, how did this come about? How do I have a mountain of wood chips in my driveway when I didn't even know where it came from? You know. It's a funny story.
A very good example of the everyday decisions that shape your life. So we're in the decision-making process, and at this point for the last section, just give people some nice concrete tips about, you know, if they know their decision-making style, you know, what are the things they can do to apply that in their, you know, in their life?
Yeah, I think regardless of the situation, there is a process that I like to recommend to everyone to really, especially if it's a pretty difficult decision, you know, a life-altering decision, a moment of tension or a moment of transition, that I try to encourage people in. And the first is, you know, related to the pile of wood chips. What are all the options that you could possibly do? I think we instantly go towards the realm of, you know, the extremes. I could either say yes and do this, or I could say no and do this. So you're not really happy with your current job. So maybe I should quit my job today and go see what's available tomorrow. Well, I don't know that that's a responsible decision, you know. So maybe the decision should be, well, maybe I should get my resume ready. You know, you don't have to leave your job to get your resume ready or to start looking for other jobs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So what are all the options possible? I think that's the first thing. The second thing, and this is a really important thing, because a lot of times we make decisions that are really focused on ourselves. But oftentimes the decisions we make affect other people. So understanding who is going to be influenced or impacted because of your decision is a really important thing to consider. Especially if you're a leader, like if there's people that are on the team with you or that look to you for direction and you're not considering how that's going to affect the other people you interact with in your position, then that's a really limited view of your decision. So really consider who is affected by this decision. So if you have a family and you're thinking about switching a job, you know, you can't just quit your job without thinking how those finances are going to affect your people, your family.
Mm-hmm.
The third thing, and we talked about this earlier, is, you know, who are you inviting to the table with you? Who do you want to help you make choices? Have you invited them to that table? Have you asked for them to speak into you and into your decisions in a really good way? Sometimes these major choices, before you make them, especially if you're an emotional being like me, I'm a gut reaction person, it's important for me to proactively seek counsel, to make wise decisions before I just, you know, run off and do an emotional decision. So who are those people, and have you invited them and heard their perspective and your decisions you're pursuing? The other thing that I think is a huge part of this, and we could probably talk about this for a while, is really understanding what fears are driving your decision or affecting your decision. And, you know, I think we all have fears. Some of us have the fear of rejection or the fear of failure. Maybe it's the fear of success. Maybe it's the fear of people knowing something about us that we aren't happy about our past. Maybe it's there's all kinds of fears, fears of finances, fears of security. All this stuff plays a role in our decision-making. Mm-hmm. So when you're in a moment of major decision, have you really defined what fears you have in that choice? Because if you're making decisions that are driven by fear, it will never be a good decision. And so that's a big thing that I think a lot of people wrestle through, including myself.
Do you think is there any?
I'm sorry. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to ask: do you see any relation to the decision-making style, and the fear that a person might have? Like, for instance, an example might be the person who does the checklist. You know, are they doing it because they want to make sure they try to eliminate anything that could possibly go wrong? You know, versus the gut style person who's like, well, I'm just going to do it and we'll see what happens. You know.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely some personality things that are correlated. I think a lot of gut reaction people rarely are fearful of failure. Their perspective oftentimes is like, there's an assumption that one out of every three or four decisions isn't going to work, but they're okay with it and they're going to move on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Versus, if a list approach person is critiquing a gut reaction person, they would oftentimes say, well, you didn't fully think that through, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so those people are trying to think of all the scenarios that could possibly happen to limit their risk, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are some correlated fears, but it's amazing the fears that emerge that have nothing to do with your personality. Maybe it is because of some past experience or, you know, fears that your family built into you. There's all different things that drive fears. But one thing I know is that the things that you're scared of, the fears, are not going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you make a decision today and overcome a fear doesn't mean that you beat it forever. You know, it'll come back tomorrow in the next decision you have to make. So it's a constant in the process, for sure.
Okay. Is there any kind of exercise that people could do around that, you know, because that it is, I think these are like lifelong traits that you come up against in the decision-making process. So anything, you know, that you've in your process of doing the book and working with people that could help identify a fear or to say, you know, ask a question that might pull it out a little more.
Yeah, I mean, I think that inside all of us, we know we're scared in those moments, but we don't want to name it, you know. So it's a very good practice to actually say, here's my fears in this decision making. So if you had a friend, you know, you think about who you're inviting to that table. They say, if you started to, you know, to start building a culture and an ethos with your friends, to say, what fears do you have in this major decision? And start to name them, talk about them. Because when you talk about them, when you put them on the table, when you can honestly have a conversation about it, it's not such a paralyzing thing anymore. It's like, hey, here's my fears. I'm nervous if this, you know, what if this doesn't work? How is this going to affect our family?
Mm-hmm.
My wife and I, you know, had to really process some of these things as a family, saying, and specifically we decided, hey, if we're going to make a major decision for our family, we are not going to let fear be the driver. We had to make that choice. So if we're committed to that, then let's talk about what our fears are and honestly share them, because they're not going to go away. But if we're going to make a significant decision, we have to choose to overcome those fears.
Right. And that your answer actually points to probably the biggest takeaway for me on the book was that, you know, a lot of times I want to try to just get right to the decision, you know, because it's actually the tension isn't good. I want to resolve it. So I'll say, okay, I'll make a decision. But, you know, in your answer, you said, well, sit down and share your fears with someone. Now, just by doing that, it would allow me to take a breath and then maybe sleep on it and wake up with a new perspective or whatever it might be. But I think that that takeaway is to take some time, allow yourself the space, which you say is that's kind of a rough thing for a lot of the American culture to handle. You know, there's this kind of instant, you want to get things done instantly.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's it's really good practice to kind of slow down, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we are caught in a never-ending busyness. And that kind of that last part of that process that you were kind of hinting at is like, yeah, are you after you've heard all this information, after you've heard all the options, you've heard who's affected, you've heard what other people think, you understand what your fears are you taking time to kind of slow down, take a moment of solitude? Maybe you might be a person that prays, maybe not. Maybe you just need to take a moment to consider what you think, given all this information. How do you move forward, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important. I like to encourage people, and especially when people are in moments of transition. So say one job ends, take some time off to process what you liked and didn't like about that previous role you had. And take some time to think about, you know, what do I hope to be known for in the future? Take time, write it down. Because
mm-hmm.
you have to kind of process through all that stuff. You need to let it go, the previous situations, and to start to dream about what's next. Most of us, though, we get caught up in, oh, I got to pay the bills, so I got to go find a job. So the minute you end one thing, you're looking for the next thing, you know? And so how do you start to build these practices and encourage that in your friends? Because it'll play a big role in what you're becoming.
Yeah, that's very, very helpful advice. The book is called Yes or No, How Your Everyday Decisions Will Forever Shape Your Life, and it's written by Jeff, and am I get this right, Schinnebarger? Or is it
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay, I got it. Okay. So, Jeff, a lot of stuff we covered today. I really appreciate your getting and digging into it. Very helpful answers. And once again, if you're interested in picking up the book for free, we do have a few copies here. So send an email to liveshow@digdeepgrow.com. Once again, Jeff, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. And yeah, and make sure if you get a chance, take the free assessment at yesornobook.com. You'll learn some new things about yourself.
Fantastic.